Hello and welcome to the Hotchkiss and Wiley podcast series. It's Wednesday, October 14th, and my name is John Hosse. Today I'm joined by Hunter Doble, portfolio manager and lead bank analyst here at Hotchkiss. Hunter has 25 years of industry experience and 15 here at Hotchkiss. The banking industry has clearly been out of favor of late, thanks in no small part to the challenges brought on by the onset of COVID-19. I will be speaking with Hunter about how near-term headwinds to the banking industry should not distract from the longer-term opportunity. But before we begin, a few disclosures. This podcast is for general information only and should not be relied on for investment advice or recommendation of any particular security, strategy, or investment product. The portfolio manager's views and opinions expressed in this podcast are as of October 14th, 2020. Such views are subject to change and may differ from others in the firm or the firm as a whole. The portfolio manager's comments include some estimated and/or forecasted views, which are believed to be based on reasonable assumptions within the bounds of current and historical information. However, there is no guarantee that any estimates, forecasts, or views will be realized. In the event of new information or changed circumstances, H&W reserves the right to change its investment perspectives and outlook. Okay, Hunter. Let's start by having you give our audience a brief overview of your experience covering banks and how today's environment really isn't so different from what you've seen before.
Sure. Thanks, John. I've been following the banking sector since 1998 and at Hotchkiss & Wiley since 2007. So certainly have followed this industry through several cycles, good periods, difficult periods. Clearly today would be in the category of a difficult period. We have recessionary economic environment, we have low rates. Those aren't easy circumstances for banks, but again, we've seen them get through difficult periods in the past, and we don't anticipate this being too different from other difficult periods. So we think that our understanding of how the banks adapt through cycles will help us understand the probability of their being able to get through this difficult period and the likely profitability of the industry on the other side.
Net interest margin contraction is a frequent topic of conversation these days. Can you discuss why bank business models are less sensitive to interest rates than generally understood?
Sure. It's certainly a comment we hear a lot that, an investment in the banks is essentially a bet on interest rates, or that banks would be impossible for them to earn good returns in a low rate environment. And we think that the actual history of the industry is a pretty strong evidence against that argument. So, to first talk about net interest margin, I want to provide some background or understanding of exactly the drivers of net interest margin. So there are essentially two primary drivers for the net interest margin of banks. The first would be the spread between what they earn on their interest-bearing assets and what they pay out on their interest-bearing liabilities, that essentially what we would call a yield spread. This yield spread has been relatively stable over time. And the reason for that is that the biggest part of the yield spread is the yield on loans. Loans are about 70% of a bank's earning assets. The yield that a bank earns on its loans are generally priced in relation to some short-term interest rate benchmarks, such as LIBOR or Fed funds. And so if you look at the yield on the bank universe loan book overall over time, you will see that, again, it tends to move with short-term interest rates, and it tends to actually move and behave in a somewhat countercyclical way, in the sense that in difficult periods, loan spreads tend to widen out. In very positive economic environments, they tend to compress a bit. But again, they fluctuate around a reasonably narrow range of outcomes. And so if you were to go back to the period of time from 2000 to 2002, a time when 3-month LIBOR averaged over 4%, the average yield on bank loans in those 3 years averaged 8%, so about a 4% spread. If you went to the bottom of the interest rate cycle in 2013 to 15, a period of time when LIBOR averaged 30 basis points, the average yield on bank loans remained over 4.5%. So again, still a 4-point spread. So the ability of the industry to get a reasonable yield on its loan book in relation to short-term interest rate benchmarks is the primary driver of the yield spread, and that is the primary driver of net interest margins. Now, in addition to that, banks also benefit from the fact that they fund part of their balance sheet with non-interest-bearing sources. So what we would call the benefit of free funding to the net interest margin. And that free funding would be the bank's equity, checking accounts, other non-interest-bearing deposit accounts. But that role and the contribution that free funding plays into the NIM is relatively small. Over the last 20 years, the average benefit to net interest margin from free funding has been around 20 basis points. whereas the average yield spread over that 20 years was about 3.2%. So the total 3.4% net interest margin that the industry averaged over the last 20 years was predominantly sourced from the yield spread. Again, this is a very different dynamic than some of the other banking systems around the world that people will point to when they start to become concerned about how poorly banks will do in a low interest rate environment. They say things like, I think the US system is becoming like Japan. We would say the primary difference between Japan and the United States is the Japanese banking industry's inability to get an adequate yield on their loan book. And for example, today, the yield on the average Japanese loan book is about 75 basis points, so far, far lower than anything in the U.S.
Capital requirements are certainly another hot topic. Can you talk a little bit about how the capital requirements in banks might not be as big a headwind as some may fear?
Sure. So, obviously, when you go into a recessionary period of time, loan losses tend to increase. That's certainly been the case over the first half of this year. It was certainly the case that in 2008-09, the banking system found themselves in a position where it needed to raise additional capital, diluting existing shareholders, a very negative outcome for the owners of the banks at that time. When we look at the banks today, however, we see a very, very different degree of capital resiliency and balance sheet strength. So just for example, the banking system overall ended 2019 with a tangible common equity to tangible asset ratio of 9.3%. That number was 7.0% at the end of 2007. So a much higher level of capital today is in the banking system than was true at that time. Additionally, many of the higher risk loan categories that gave the banking industry so much trouble in the 2008-2009 time period are far, far smaller or non-existent. So subprime mortgages, subprime home equity loans, lower prime and subprime credit card loans, all far smaller loan categories today than they were at that time. Construction lending, another area where the banks have substantially de-risked. So again, as we look at the bank's capital ratios, we look at the likely credit losses that they may incur in a recession. We feel very comfortable that the banks will, again, continue to remain well above their regulatory capital requirements. And just, you know, again, when we try to think about, well, how bad would losses need to get before we begin to become concerned about capital ratios, you know, we would point to the Dodd-Frank stress test that the banks are put through each year. And what you see when you look at that would be an assumption by the Federal Reserve around the likely losses over a 2-year period of extremely difficult economic environments. And for the banks, you know, those would be something like cumulative losses over 2 years of 5 to 6 to 7% of the loan book, depending on the kind of loan mix that a bank has. When we look at the banks that we own today, and we look at their existing allowance, which in many cases is equal to about half of that expected loss in a Dodd-Frank stress test scenario, plus their excess capital, the excess capital and existing allowance in most cases is already greater than the expected losses the banks would incur through a 2-year stress scenario. In addition to that, the banks continue to generate pre-provision income that will further augment their capital. So in all cases, the banks that we own today at Hotchkiss and Wiley have the ability to work through an environment considerably worse than what the Fed assumes in its stress case scenario. And in many cases, losses would have to be more than double what is estimated by the Fed in the severely adverse scenario before any of these banks found themselves to see capital ratios low enough that they would need to dilute shareholders to increase their capital.
Now, many banks today are trading at very low multiples of what they've earned in 2019, for instance. Can you talk a little bit about how those valuations may not accurately reflect future earnings power?
When we look at a lot of the banks that we hold at Hotchkiss and Wiley, we see valuations that are mid-single digit multiples of last year's earnings, valuations that are at deep discounts to tangible book. Again, valuations that to us imply either a substantial dilution of shareholders, you know, for the purpose of augmenting capital, or a permanently lowered earnings profile, one that would suggest returns on capital way below cost of capital. And again, when we step back and look at what we think of as a likely future outcome, and we start to incorporate more adverse scenarios, okay, the permanent existence of 0% short rates and extremely low long-term rates, The adjustments to our earnings that result from those types of assumptions are still in the neighborhood of 10 to 20% lower. So you could have a business that we think of as being valued at, you know, again, in our math, on our normal earnings power, something 5 or 6 times earnings. If we then embedded instead a permanent 0% interest rate environment, we're still talking about valuations that are single digit multiples of the earnings that would result from that kind of scenario, dividend yields that are far higher than the market overall. And again, we think businesses that continue to generate returns on capital in excess of the cost of capital.
Now we're day two in the bank earnings season. Has there been anything the last couple of days that you've learned that's different from what you expected, or is everything pretty much going according to plan at this point? And feel free to share a couple of examples if you wish.
Sure. So I would describe the earnings that we've seen so far to have been roughly in line with what we'd expect. You know, low interest rates are, in fact, depressing net interest income. They're lower than they would be if rates were a little higher, but they are not to the point where the banks are not able to generate adequate returns on capital. The very large provisions that banks took in the first half of the year have eased. The need to build allowance for future loan losses has moderated, so the provision expense was more in line with net charge-offs. And we saw banks that, for the most part, were producing high single digit, low double digit returns on tangible capital, which we think is a pretty good outcome, again, given the challenging environment that they're operating within. So again, as a group, I would say that what we're seeing is ongoing growth in tangible book value per share, the ability to kind of work through a very difficult environment. There's obviously uncertainty around just how significant credit losses ultimately will be. It certainly looks as though the losses that the banking system anticipated in the first and second quarter may not be as bad as they thought at that time, but we can't say for sure exactly how it will play out. But what we do feel is quite comfortable that the ongoing generation of capital by the industry, the existing capital they have and the allowances they've already set aside can handle an extremely dire outcome, one far worse than that is priced into other equities or the equity market overall. So again, it's a difficult environment for sure. And I think that if it remains that way, we own stocks that have high dividend yields, that have attractive multiples of current earnings, single digit multiples of current earnings. And again, we think ability to be more resilient than the market currently anticipates.
One of our largest holdings is Wells Fargo. How did you view their earnings that came out?
Wells has continued to be challenged by low rates, be challenged by the asset cap that the Federal Reserve has imposed upon them, and challenged by the elevated expenses that have been incurred in an attempt to remediate the operational weaknesses they have been identified. So the results were not strong. I would certainly say that they're weaker than we think of as normal. But again, I think it's important to put all of this in context. I would say that the earnings, after backing out the litigation expense that they had and a few other one-time items, probably in the neighborhood of 60 to 65 cents. So the stock today at 23.25 trades at less than 10 times that annualized rate. Additionally, we would just make the point that with a market cap today of $96 billion, we're talking about a multiple that is less than 5 times the level of net income the business generated every year from 2013 to 2018. So this is a business that has produced over $20 billion of net income most of the last decade, a business that had average return on tangible common equity of 17% from 2012 to 2018, which today trades at something like 60% of tangible book. So the profitability implied by the current valuation is so far below what it has historically produced. We think that that is a very unusual opportunity for us, but it's certainly the case that in the near term, it will take time for them to extract the expenses, to take the expenses out of the business that have built up, and hopefully to ultimately become freed of the asset cap that the Fed has imposed upon them, because that has imposed numerous operational burdens upon the business that has made it hard for them to fully realize the value of the very dominant, strong franchise and customer base that they have.
And Hunter, can you speak a little bit about Citigroup and some of the changes that have taken place over there and what's transpired with their earnings as well so far this quarter?
Sure. So Citi, I would describe as having relatively good results. They've been helped by strong trading activity. They've been hurt by low interest rates. But in total, we're talking about a business that earned somewhere between $1.50 and $1.60 in the quarter, depending on how one wants to adjust for one-time items. So that would be kind of an implied $6 or a little more than that annual earnings, and it trades at $43. So a very, very low multiple of what they're earning today, an extremely low multiple of what they earned last year. They've been profitable year to date, despite the building up of significant allowance. And the primary concern appears to be, again, when you look at an extreme valuation like that, the primary concern appears to be fear around the consent order that Citi had to agree to with the Federal Reserve and the OCC related to operational weaknesses stemming from, you know, internal controls that were deemed to be unsatisfactory by the regulators. Clearly, they're going to spend some money to improve those operations. We don't think that the market's conclusion or apparent conclusion that Citigroup is the next Wells Fargo is accurate. We think that the errors by Citigroup were not nearly as pervasive as what Wells Fargo did. They didn't involve a fraud. They didn't involve harm of customers. They were an internal operational mistake, and they can be improved upon. But we don't think that the set of data is really comparable, and we don't think that the ultimate effect of these restrictions will be comparable either. So we see a business that is probably going to have to undertake and incur elevated expenses over the next year or two, but the magnitude of those are moderate. And we see a valuation that continues to be really, really disconnected with the level of profitability that has recently produced and what we expect it to produce again in the future. So again, it's a business that built tangible book value by 4% year over year, despite doubling the allowance and booking and setting aside huge provisions earlier this year for the potential credit losses that the market was anticipating and that the bank was anticipating earlier this year.
All right, great. Thanks, Hunter.
You're welcome.
As we look to wrap up, is there anything else we haven't covered that you'd like to share?
No, I just think that, as we've described, the banking industry is substantially out of favor. The industry is going through typical cyclical challenges in the form of elevated provision expense and relatively low interest rates. These aren't new things for the industry. We spent 5 or 6 of the years from 2010 to 2016 with a 0% interest rate environment. The industry overall still was able to generate returns on tangible common equity more than 10%. We think that they'll be able to work through this environment in a similar way. And so we just think that the valuation opportunity offered by a number of banks is really unusual, particularly when compared to the broader market, which, you know, trades at, you know, more than 20 times earnings, depending on what benchmark one looks at. So again, we think it's a very interesting opportunity. We think that the experience of 2008, 2009 is still fresh in people's memory and gives people caution and concern around the financial stability and strength of this industry. And I think what people are missing is just the huge improvement in the capital position and the huge improvement in the loan and asset quality of the industry when compared to that prior time period that was difficult.
Well, the banks do present a very compelling opportunity, and this is very good information, Hunter. So thank you very much for your time. And with that, we thank you for your interest in Hotchkiss & Wiley. For further information, please visit our website at hwcm.com or call us at 888-596-4926. Thank you.